This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Memento Morbid, where we explore death, life, and the in-between. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein, founder of Morbid Anatomy, which is an organization and community devoted to these very themes. As many of you already know, Memento Morbid is an independently produced podcast. If you like what you hear and you'd like to support us, we have just created a new Buy Me a Coffee page. You can now make a small donation there, and you'll find it at buymeacoffee.com/Memento Morbid Podcast. And finally, if you'd like to take a little piece of Memento Morbid with you over the summer, you can visit our online store where you'll find a variety of merchandise, t-shirts, sweatshirts, stickers, mugs, and more, all featuring our gorgeous logo, designed by death doula and artist Lauren Seeley. And you can browse this collection at mementomorbidmerch.dashery.com. Today we're going to be venturing into a spiritual tradition in which the living and the dead are never truly separate. Our guest has spent decades studying and living these traditions as an author, teacher, and an initiated practitioner. Their work bridges anthropology, history, and lived spirituality, and challenges many of the myths we've inherited about death, magic, and the invisible world.
There was a fish that is in the Caribbean that's similar to the Japanese fugu fish that causes paralysis. So you would give people this combination of herbs and fish and things. It would slow their heart rate and they would appear dead. So people would have a funeral because it's the Caribbean and you got to bury people quick because it's hot. And they would go and dig them up again later and transport them to a different village far away and make them work like a field hand. And they never really could remember their name or where they were from.
Today, I am so pleased to welcome Lilith Dorsey. It is rare to find someone who is both an expert and a practitioner, and today's guest spans these worlds with grace, humor, erudition, and passion. Lilith is an author, filmmaker, initiated spiritual practitioner, and a morbid anatomy instructor. I very much admire her work, which brings together rigorous scholarship and practical lived experience. Their work is grounded in history, culture, and tradition, and it is also deeply human, inviting us to think differently about our relationship to the ancestors, about remembrance, about ritual, and about how we connect with the unseen. And in a time when so many living spiritual traditions have been misunderstood or sensationalized, Lilith has spent decades helping people look beyond the myths in order to discover the richness, nuance, and wisdom that lies behind them. All right. So Lilith, welcome to Memento Morbid. It's wonderful to have you.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really excited to get all morbid with you.
I love getting morbid with you too. And especially someone who has their feet in both worlds, I always say. Someone who has fully in the realm of rigorous scholarship and fully in the realm of being a practitioner is so rare. And someone who can communicate what the spiritual part of your experience is for those of us who have not traveled in your footsteps. So I'm so excited to have you.
Oh, thank you. It was always important to me to have that like foundation, right? Like, because I can report on what I'm doing, but you know, what's everybody else doing and what's the scholarship and theory behind it? Like, that's so important to me.
Yeah. And so to jump into that, can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you do?
Oh, okay, great. Probably I would say New Orleans voodoo and other African traditional religions. I am initiated in New Orleans voodoo. I have my own spiritual house here in New Orleans where I live. But then I also have initiations in Haitian voodoo from an amazing Gros Mambo named Bonnie Devlin, who a lot of people are familiar with because, well, she was a Sambista, she was a Santera, she was a Gros Mambo. She worked a lot with some of the groups in New York City. She was a master drummer. She was a Harvard-trained minister. So again, right, like I've got someone who's like actually a practitioner, but also like, you know, an educated, serious, divine person, right? Like, and I also have initiations in Lukumi, which most people know as Santeria. And it's funny because my Santera, she's no longer with us either, Oshun Olukari Alaye, but She also had her doctorate in psychology, which I think was very helpful to me when I was learning and things like that, because she understood the psych behind it, and then she also understood the like practical day-to-day of this is what it means to be a spiritual person. So, yeah, my practice combines all of those, although I'm primarily a New Orleans voodoo priestess, because that's kind of a spiritual gumbo of things, like I like to say, right?
Totally.
But
And a great
yeah.
metaphor. I would also love to know a bit about how you got to studying and practicing these areas, a bit about your background and what brought you to this work and this scholarship.
I feel like there were so many things. I mean, my parents named me Lilith, so I always have to start
Oh,
with
you're
that,
right. I
right?
thought it might have been a chosen name. I didn't know it's your given name. Wow,
No, that's my given
that's a heavy name to carry. Do you want to talk for listeners who might not be familiar with Lilith a little bit about who she is?
Yeah, Lilith is an ancient Sumerian goddess. I mean, dates back, thousands and thousands of years. Some people say up to 6,000 years. She was kind of the primordial woman, right? Like the proto goddess out there. She sort of gets incorporated into the biblical story as the first wife of Adam, who was divine and refused to, I love this phrasing, lie beneath. Right? Like you can read into that whatever you want. But, she wasn't gonna listen to his rules and this whole kind of toxic masculinity that goes on for thousands of years. So she sort of flew off into the night sky and sort of took that as her realm. But so much of the scholarship we have on her is so demonized and so brought down, right? Like, and you said it's a heavy name. I've met other people, they're like, they'll be in a cab or something. They'll be like, are you Lilith? Get out of the cab. It's bad luck. You're evil. Right? Like, too funny. So, but I think there were a lot of practical things that I learned growing up, a lot of folk magic things. I think a lot of us grew up with things like stir the pot in the kitchen this way and, don't let a dark-haired person walk into the house on New Year's Eve and all of these kinds of things that I just sort of grew up thinking that, oh, everybody does this, right? Like, and the older I got, the more I realized, oh, these are magical things and not everybody still does them. But the academic part and the sort of professional part came when I was in undergrad and college, and I was getting my degree in anthro. And the professor said, there's no magic in the United States today. There's no such thing as witchcraft. And I was like, you're a pale, stale, and male idiot. I'm not listening to this, right? Like, and my daughters were little at that time, and I wanted them to really have a positive representation, both practically and academically, of what was going on out there, something to honor their heritage. So that's when I first started, writing and publishing and studying in earnest, I think, about it. Yeah,
Oh, that's
definitely.
amazing. And did you have, when you were growing up, was your family religious at all? I know they had these kind of magical practices, but was there like a overarching religious construct or more just kind of lived?
I mean, my parents, they were about as, 60s age of Aquarius as you could
Oh,
imagine. So
lucky
there was
you.
no, they were one of the first, I think they got married 6 months after it was legal for black and white people to get married in the
That
United
is so
States, which is
interesting.
amazing to me, right? Right. And they were both LGBTQ. So that was, again, sort of a pioneering thing in the late 60s, early 70s. So I think they really didn't have any kind of formalized magic other than practical things that they did. And I grew up with my grandparents as well. And they were sort of, lapsed Catholic, converted Protestant. So, like, I got the Bible study and they sent me to Lutheran school. So I know my Bible and all of those kinds of things and whatnot. But we really didn't put any stock in it at all.
That's super interesting. We had interviewed earlier on the show, we interviewed Yvonne Chouraud. I don't know if you listened to that
Oh,
episode.
I love Yvonne Chouraud.
I love Yvonne
Yes.
Chouraud too. And I was re rereading her book, Black Magic, where she kind of talks about how hoodoo was like a practice that was complementary to Christianity a lot of the time, that there were these kind of two separate paths that didn't quite meet, but that many people, and I'm kind of hearing that a little bit in what you're talking about, and I wonder if that resonates for you.
Yeah, I think especially back then when people didn't talk about it as openly as we do now, that, someone praying to a saint or praying to Mother Mary, I think that was easier for mainstream society to understand, oh, we're worshiping, Mother Mary, as instead of saying I'm worshiping the divine goddess, right? Like that predates Christianity. So it was easy to slip into that. My grandfather was Sicilian, and they
Interesting.
always had this giant kind of, okay, you've lost something, Saint Peter with the keys, right? Like Saint Joseph, Saint Michael protect us, all of those things. It's funny to hear me, like, my great grandmother had Florida water in her house and would bless herself with that, which I think a lot of people from African traditional religions would think of as a strict traditionally like ATR thing, right? So, but no, even my Sicilian grandmother used it. I have Peruvian friends that use it.
Wait,
So,
can you explain what ATR is for those of us that might not know?
okay,
Sorry.
sure. African traditional religion.
Thank you.
So
Thank you.
it's usually the religions that came out of Nigeria, Ifa, the Vodou that came out of Benin. And I think that and them in the diaspora. So we're talking about Cuba and Santeria, New Orleans Voodoo, even Macumba in Brazil can trace some of its roots back there to West Africa. And there's a couple of theories as to why that happened, but I think that because that's where a lot of the ships deported for the enslaved people, that a lot of those beliefs were sort of carried over here to the quote unquote new world that we was not new except to the colonizers, but whatever,
And hearing, I'm really struck to, I'm very, very interested in African diasporic religions. And I was watching this really interesting documentary on Esu, the god Esu, and talking about what was really about Yoruba religious traditions and how they've lived on in these different forms. And I'm just so struck with how the longevity, the ability they have to thrive and survive in inhospitable terrains, in all these different situations, I feel like they've lived on in a way that not all religions have managed to do, and they've also been demonized. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that, about this kind of the African diasporic overview here.
I mean, I think the religion itself, while being really traditional and rigid, which, a lot of people don't like that, what you have all these rules and you have to do this and that. And it does have those rules and you do have to do this and that, but it's also very fluid. So it was able to, as I mentioned with the saints, on the one hand, somebody could see a giant statue of Saint Michael and think, oh, okay, well, that's just the Archangel Michael for protection. But if you were a Santo practitioner, you would see Saint Michael as being a representation of Ogou, which when we go back to Africa is Gu, the spirit of iron. So the spirit of both healing and also protection and the military and things like that, because it's metal, right? Like, and almost in a way, it takes on this character of technology because it's metal. So when we learned how to make metals, that was our first magical foray into creating something with technology, right? We had the ability to transform with the alchemy of metals and make something new.
And that makes me think
And
too of the myth of the watcher angels, right, who came down and taught mankind the arts of metalwork and jewelry
yes.
and weapons. So this is these theories, these themes, these archetypes are really alive and on many levels, right?
Yeah, they are. And for us, we have the concept of Ashe. So what we're honoring is the sacred energy of the thing. So when we're honoring Saint Michael or Ogou or Gu, whatever form it is, that's literally the spirit of forged metal. So iron or forged metal for a long time in Nigeria, instead of swearing on the Bible, you'd have the option to swear on a piece of metal, which I'm like, oh my gosh, I would never do that, right? Like, I
Because
don't
it
want to
could
anger
destroy
metal.
you.
Yes, metal could destroy you so many times over, right?
Totally.
Like, so I think that's fascinating. But for us, I think that is one of the reasons it's so fluid, because it can be that. It can be, yes, we see the Archangel Michael, who's simultaneously an archangel, but also a priest of Ogou who understands the knowledge of metalsmithing and blacksmithing and all of those kinds of things. So I think that's fascinating, and that's one reason it sort of held over and could also blend with other traditions and things of that nature. And the other thing is, Baba John Mason from the Yoruba Theological Seminary, I was listening to him once, and he said the religions are like fractals and they can make themselves as small or as large as they need to
Oh,
be.
I love
And
that.
that to me just sort of resonated, right? Like, so I can have a ceremony in my living room with three people, and that's really small and intimate. But I could also go, and I've done public ceremonies with 2,000, 3,000 people. You know, when I was at Bonnaroo, we did a spell for 10,000 people in the audience, right?
Wow.
Like, so it doesn't matter how large or how small it is, it still carries that sacred energy of it, and we can tap into that. So I think that really helped again too, because it didn't matter. You didn't need, like, you know, like witchcraft, you need a high priest and a high priestess and a coven of 13 and all these things. We could do it small or we could do it really big.
Yeah, so it's like infinitely adaptable. Yeah, that's super interesting. And why do you think these religions have been so demonized in the Western tradition? Is it just a fear because this is, the people that the colonists were trying to control who had access to this power? What are your thoughts about that? And just, Lilith is a great example, your name even,
Yeah, right. Like, I mean, I think they feared the power of magic, right? They feared the ability of magic to sort of be that great equalizer. Because if I have somebody that's, you know, enslaving me or torturing me or, you know, taking my children, I have something that's strong enough to fight back with that. So let me demonize it, you know? And if we look, you know, you're talking about Lilith. If we look back historically, these sort of colonizers, invaders, the first thing they always did was sort of destroy the divine feminine, whatever magic religion was in place, and stick their thing on top of it, incorporating whatever they could into it, right? Like Sulis Minerva and all of those early Roman examples come to mind. But they would sort of take all of that, turn it into something else, take the good bits, you know, literally like cultural rape, right? Like we're taking the good bits and we're gonna demonize the bad bits so nobody can do that. You know, when we look at Lilith, I obviously originally she would help women in childbirth, which is such a, you know, difficult slash dangerous time even today. And but then what do they say? Oh, she kills babies, she steals babies, she does all these terrible things. She's, you know, there to bring miscarriage as opposed to bring about successful birth. And that's terrifying. And why would anybody want anything to do with that? So I'm really happy we have a reclaiming now.
Well, I can tell you this. I was in Mexico City recently at the Sonora Market. Have you been there before? It's the
No, I've never
witchcraft
been to
market.
Mexico City.
Okay. It's amazing. It's a giant market that has a lot of materials for different kinds of religious traditions, different kinds of magical traditions. And so there's all sorts of statues of different figures for sale. And now one regularly sees Hecate and one sees Lilith. I saw a life size. I'll
Wow.
send you a photo, or we'll put it
Oh, that's great.
in our notes. It was amazing. It was a life-size, naked, powerful woman with horns, red, with the feet of claws, like a bird claw, and of a snake winding around her leg. And I did ask a few people, because I hadn't seen so many Liliths before, and they said, yes, she's becoming increasingly popular, and women are the ones buying her.
Wow, that's beautiful. I love
Me
that.
too. Me too.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to this, what you're saying. I think that idea of the fractal is so interesting. Like, it doesn't go away, it gets small, but then when it's ready for being reclaimed, it's still there. And what an
Yes.
excellent thing to be able to be reclaimed by women in a Western culture that might not have access to the kind of badass deities you
Right.
have in the African diasporic tradition, right?
Yes, definitely. I love that. Now I gotta get one of those statues. I send my friend because he's from Ciudad de Mexico. So I
Okay.
send him all the time. I'm like, and he calls me. He's like, which one do you want? And I'm like, are you legit in the market calling me right now? I'm like, okay, good.
I know you're fighting so many misconceptions around voodoo. Voodoo has such a strong, brings on a reactionary feeling in a lot of people that they understand it and that it's evil and wrong and scary. And I think there's something particular about voodoo and the traditions you're working in. I would love for you to talk a little bit about how you think it got that way, what you think is wrong about it, and how you're trying to present it so people can see something different.
Oh, what a great question. Well, pretty much everything is wrong about it, right?
Okay.
Like, they just don't get it right. I mean, we look at Hollywood, we look at, you said you had Yvonne Chiron on, we look at comic books, we look at all of these things that have been the sort of popular media for the past at least 100 years and before about the negative things about it. And we look at, if we look here in New Orleans, we've got Congo Square, which was where Marie Laveau used to have ceremonies. They used to have drum circles. Before that, it was an indigenous gathering place for thousands of years. But if you look at it, it's right on the edge of Rampart Street. So when we had these sort of colonizers come in and create the French Quarter, not just the French, but the Spanish, it was the Rampart Street, and the garbage dump was on the other side of it. So first they take our holy sacred lands and they make a dump out of it,
Wow.
literally. And then they outlawed drumming, they outlawed dancing, they outlaw all of these things because, oh, well, maybe that's, them really secretly communicating. And legit, sometimes there were, I teach a class about the sacred dances. There were movements in the dances that were like, okay, you see that military guy over here, it goes like this, and then they cut their head off. There's a dance move, it's like, oh, you chop their head off, right? Like, so, but of course there were, because they were being oppressed and tortured and all of these things. So, I think that in, again, in order for those that were in power, unfortunately, to try and get rid of us, they had to other us, and they had to call us, savages, and it's and then there also had to be this whole level of appropriation in it as well. It makes me think of bell hooks and her essay Desire and Eating the Other.
Could you speak a little bit about that? I don't know about that, so maybe some of our listeners aren't familiar with it. It sounds really
Oh,
interesting.
yeah, okay. She wrote this whole essay about how there's sort of consumption of Black culture by, the colonizing Western world powers that be. If we look at some of the foods that were, lobster used to be a slave meal, right?
Wow, I
Like,
didn't know that.
and all of these things that are, thought of as stuff that was, what was the worst that was left over for us that we were allowed to have, is now a delicacy and we can't have it. So it's just sort of taking everything away from us, sort of commodifying it, turning it into something else. And it's gotten really ugly. It's gotten really, really ugly. And, in this way of sort of sanitizing it or watering it down, literally, that was a way to rob us of our culture. And that's what bell hicks talks about in that essay. It's an interesting essay.
Yeah, well, I would say the metaphor she's using there reminds me a lot, as we were talking to Yvonne Chiroux about her work with Sinners, of the film Sinners, and the, those Irish singers who wanted the power of Black music and wanted to kind of take it over,
Yeah, it's just this sort of othering and consumption, and it just goes so deep. There's so many levels and layers to it, and it really is, legit about stealing your soul and your spirit along the way, and doing what they want to with it. And it's really sad to me, but we try and fight.
When you say that, I think about the zombie as well. Is that a post-slavery concept, the zombie, or did it exist before?
So it's funny because Zora Neale Hurston actually wrote about this in some of her unpublished works and a little bit in her published works. But she had gone down to Haiti with her work with the Works Progress Administration in the 30s. And she talked about discovering this formula for turning somebody into a zombie. Now, it's not like Walking Dead, like we see on TV or on Sinners or anything like that. Basically, it was a combination of herbs. There was a fish that is in the Caribbean that's similar to the Japanese fugu fish that causes paralysis. So you would give people this combination of herbs and fish and things. It would slow their heart rate and they would appear dead. So people would have a funeral because it's the Caribbean and you got to bury people quick because it's hot. And they would go and dig them up again later and transport them to a different village far away and make them work like a field hand. And they never really could remember their name or where they were from. It's kind of like having a stroke, I guess, from, loss of blood to the brain. But that's what they would do in some of these communities that didn't have the kind of justice that they needed to deal with objectionable people. So if someone was a child molester or a wife beater or something, very often this is what would happen to them. They'd just get disappeared to somewhere else where they didn't remember anything. And then the people that they left behind would be safer. So that's what Zora talks about. That's what it was, and then fast forward, we've got Wade Davis and Hollywood and, you know, all of this kind of Serpent and the Rainbow thing coming up where he's sort of turning it into this scary zombie type thing.
Yeah.
White Zombie, that was the first time we ever had the kind of representation of this dark forest magic that'll make you lose your mind, you know. And it just sort of grew from there. Some people don't even remember zombies ever had anything to do with Haitian voodoo, which I think is funny, but it's true. That's that. And that's what it came from. It wasn't this kind of thing where, you know, there were legions of zombies returning. But it does sort of remind me of some of those, you know, duppy stories that we get out of Obeya in Jamaica. Yes. And like, I mean, I guess some of them found their way back to the town and they were angry, right?
I'm actually reading that right now. I'm reading Zora Neale Hurston's Tell It to My Horse. And she, I just read the part about the guppies this morning before our meeting. Or duppies, sorry, duppies. I'd never heard of that before. Funny. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Bob Marley sings about the Duppy Conqueror,
I did not
right?
know that. No, I didn't know.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, he's got a song about the Duppy Conqueror, like where if somebody's got to go out and kill whatever zombies are coming back before we're in trouble. So, but yeah, it's just, again, it's like a folktale that they used to tell kids about the Duppy. Be careful, someone will make you a Duppy, you know, eat your vegetables, brush your teeth, you know.
Yeah. And so for listeners that might not know that, from what I understood in the book, Duppies are souls of the dead that aren't able to go to rest for various reasons. There's all these rituals that keep a soul from becoming a duppy. And if it becomes a duppy, then it's quite dangerous to the people left behind.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, definitely. That's what she talks about, right? So for me, again, it's this kind of like undead dead, right? Like you don't go to your right place. You're just sort of wandering almost. So yeah. So zombies, I think, would be the first thing. Voodoo dolls is the one that I'm always on my high horse about, because that really doesn't have anything to do with Haitian voodoo at all.
Really?
Yeah, we don't. Now you'll see tourists will buy dolls. I think originally it came from, you know, the Yoruba in Nigeria have the highest incidence of twins in the world.
Really?
So what they will, so what they will do if one of the twins dies is they'll make a doll of that twin. And the custom is to have that doll like at family parties and holidays and stuff like that, just to represent the twin. They give it a plate of food. They, you know, talk to it like it was still there, to just sort of be like a spiritual place marker for the one that's died. Mm. And so that's the only time we get dolls in West Africa, really. Mm. And so, but it's sort of transformed into this voodoo sympathetic magic thing, which is really more of a Celtic poppet tradition.
Yeah, that's what I that's what I was thinking when you were talking about it. I've seen it much more there than I have. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of makes me think visually. I wonder if part of what people were responding to are those incredible African statues that have all the nails in them. Those are not used. Those are not like voodoo dolls. They're used. What are the, I'm trying to remember why the nails are put in.
They're Nkisi. They're African spirits. They're sort of ancestor spirits, protector spirits they're put in. But they kind of both protection, but to sort of soak up any negativity that might be in the area, right? So it's kind of a dual purpose for it. And I'm mentioning that because I know people who've got, you know, a room full of Nkisis that they collected. It's not the kind of thing you necessarily want to have in your house.
Yeah, they're pretty powerful looking objects.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I think it's that. I think it's, I mean, the British colonized, you know, Nigeria and the Yoruba people. So if we think about, oh, British people looking at these dolls that the Nigerians had for dead people, it just sort of, you know, it makes sense that it got fuzzy, right? And
absolutely,
it got turned into this other thing. So that I don't think is true. Voodoo also gets really sexualized, which is one of the things that I think is hilarious to me, because like in the religion, sex is kept as far as possible away from these things. Mm. Like sex is seen as a personal thing between you and your partner or partners. And you don't bring that to ritual. You don't bring it to the altar or the shrine or the sacred space. There's cleansing rituals you have to do after sex before you go into ritual or sacred space, because that's seen as, there isn't even really right a word for it, but it's seen as having an energy on you that's not respectful to give to the spirits, I explain it to people like, you know, hopefully you're not having sex in front of your grandma, right? Because that wouldn't be respectful. So this is, it's kept very separate. And that's the thing. But again, it gets so sexualized with Hollywood, things like Angel Heart and these other movies where they're just people are naked and la, 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 you know.
Yeah. We've touched on Zora Neale Hurston, and when I was reading and doing some research on your background, I was reading that you were inspired by Zora Neale Hurston and Maya Deren. And I was really struck. Both of them had always interested me. Also, just to kind of come back to where we started, that they started as scholars, as far as I can understand, but both of them became practitioners. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about what it is that inspires you about them and how you see it tying into your own work.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like they totally inform all of my work. I started out as a filmmaker. You know, I did my undergrad in film production at NYU, and then I had to leave in my senior year and went off to get an anthro degree. But I was like, you know, into this idea of being able to have magic on film, right? And this is something that fascinated both of them. It was really inspiring to me that Zora was the first Black female anthropologist. She studied with Franz Boas up at Columbia University. For any anthro nerds out there, right? Franz Boas was the father of anthropology. And she chose to study voodoo and hoodoo and other African traditional religions. So that was really inspirational to me. I went back to NYU to do my grad work they have a special program called Culture and Media. Started out being visual anthropology, but it's like a joint program between cinema studies and anthropology, where you make documentaries, you research documentaries, things like that. So it was fascinating to me that Zora also made ethnographic film. She was one of the first, I think, Black women to make ethnographic films, certainly about voodoo. At that time, when I was in school, her films were not released. They were locked in the vaults at the Library of Congress. So I was working with a woman named Elaine Charnoff, who sort of rediscovered these films there and started writing about them. And Elaine had said to me, do you want to go down and look at them and tell me what's voodoo and what isn't? So I was so happy that I got the opportunity to go down and sort of look at these films, which are such amazing testament to visual anthropology in this discipline.
Can these films be seen by us punters? Like, where can we find these films?
Yes, they did. The Library of Congress did release them, I think, or the Smithsonian. They're out there.
Okay.
So you can see pieces of them on YouTube.
That's great.
It's very fascinating. You know, you even see Zora drumming in one of the rituals and stuff like that. Like, it's so amazing to me. So that was inspirational to me. And Maya Deren, again, also went to NYU. She was in the journalism school.
That.
But yes, she did.
So this is NYU connection. This is so interesting.
There is. It's weird.
It is weird. Like, so, but I'm not surprised somehow, because they do have very forward thinking, very progressive kind of visual culture and studying.
Yeah, I mean, historically, too, right? Like, my culture and media program is relatively young. You know, I think it's only been around for 20, 25 years. You know, we keep having reunions. It's great. But just the fact that they were doing this so many years before, right? And Maya Deren, in addition to being a voodoo priestess, also wrote a lot about theory and film theory and, like, the magic of film and the magic of movement. You know, I'm a dancer as well. So that really intrigued me, the fact that she was sort of incorporating these things. And she shot Divine Horseman, which again was just sort of a huge testament to visual ethnography and voodoo. But the thing that always got me is she shot like 8 or 9 hours worth of raw footage, and she could never edit it. And her husband edited it after she she was dead. So it was like this thing where she couldn't figure out what to leave out of the ritual, because these rituals go on and on, and what's important to show somebody and what's important to not show somebody. So that whole concept was fascinating to me. And I still haven't seen the whole 9 hours. That they did show that at the film archives on Second Avenue once.
Wow.
But somebody told me last summer, they're like, you should get them to show that again, which I really want them to. So hopefully.
Please let us know if that happens. Well, I would love to see that. We can help amplify that to our audience. That's I'm really interested in what you're saying about magic and film. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about what you see as the connections between film and magic, because I think there's something really rich there.
Yeah, I mean, film is just such a magical medium, right? Like, yes, you're in the dark, you're immersed by all these things. I do a workshop where I talk about early film being made out of silver nitrate and spontaneously going into flames, right? So if that doesn't sound like alchemy, I don't know what is, right? Like, you put this thing and then flames come out and what's happening? So, but just this way in which it's more of an immersive event almost, mm-hmm, that I think is fascinating, you know, that the film allows us to feel like we're really there or we're really part of something. Mm. And then we throw in this challenge of representing the sacred through film, which I think just adds a whole nother level of excitement for me. You know, I always made experimental films. I made films that weren't linear because, you know, again, anybody who knows magic knows it's not linear. You know, like that, where you're talking about Sinners, that wonderful scene in Sinners where the ancestors are dancing with the people in the present and the babies from
Incredible.
The future, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I think we've all experienced those moments. And I love Sinners for the fact that the way they showed that,
me
right?
Too.
Like,
me too.
With all of those things going in together and the music layered on top of it and the dance and all of that was just so beautiful. But I really think it's a challenge. You know, I've made a couple of documentaries about it. I think it's a real challenge as to what we include and how people process that and understand it. When I was in grad school, I had a very devout Catholic who was in class with me, and he's like, "No, if your films terrify me." And I'm like, "Well, good, that's what they're supposed to do, right?" You're supposed to feel yourself slipping into this other realm the way you are when you're in a good ritual, right? Like, so it's supposed to have those things there. So what do we include there? What do we leave out?
Like, yeah,
that was my adherence struggle. And I think it's something I've struggled with, but hopefully I did a film recently for, we have a group here called Balbancha Public Access Radio, and they're an indigenous cooperative here in New Orleans. And I did a film for them last summer that was completely experimental. And I think I may be onto something.
I think you are onto something. And when I was listening, I was really struck when you were just speaking, when you talked about how, you know, a good ritual takes you out of this reality and into another, is how I heard you say it anyway. And I was also struck by the fact that it was frightening to people. And then I'm thinking about horror, which is something that Yvonne and I were talking about as well. Like, why do you think that in the Western industrialized affluent world, you know, that it's really defined by fear, this idea of moving into another realm, it seems to me, and not a realm of the sacred?
I think there's a fear because so many, especially I was talking about my friend who was a rigid Christian, there's so many people who have these very rigid ideas about what reality is and how the world works and all of those things. So anytime that they see anything that sort of doesn't speak to that or runs contrary to that, that makes them very nervous, because then they realize that there are other things out there and they don't know how to control it. They've lost control. They're in the unknown, all of that stuff, right? So, and they get fear because they were told to have fear, right? Yeah. So many of these things were frowned upon with these sort of staunch right-wing Christian beliefs. So diverging from that at all makes people really nervous if that's what they were raised with, you know?
Do you have advice for those out there who might be curious about these traditions and afraid about how they might overcome a little bit of their fear?
I mean, I think, you know, knowing is half the battle, right? G.I. Joe.
Is that G.I. Joe?
Quoting G.I. Joe here. But no, in the sense of just learning about it, right? Yeah. So many of us, especially here in Western society, grew up learning, you know, everybody's talking about the Odyssey and everything like that. I grew up with Greek and Roman myths. I know them so well. They drilled them into my head. But how many people know the African myths? How many people know the African stories, right?
Yes.
We talk about liminal spaces, the spaces in between, the space of the unknown. And I think that that's where we can see possibility, and we shouldn't necessarily fear that, you know?
Yeah, I think that's so interesting and so important. And, I'm one of my areas of research is death traditions around the world. And, you know, I've been really struck lately thinking about how so many death traditions around the world, and I would love to hear about those in the African diasporic tradition. I assume they might have some overlap with this, but the idea of death is not really the end. It's more an end to a certain state of being, and then there's a transformation of some sort that occurs, right? And I think in the Judeo-Christian tradition, or at least the Christian tradition, often this idea of this underworld, this space of transformation, becomes a place of punishment. And I think there becomes a fear of that necessary transformation.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have a lot of interesting ideas. And that's one of the reasons I really love these traditions, because there's such a heavy reliance on ancestor worship and contacting your ancestors and staying in communication with them. So it's kind of like they've moved on to a different space, but they haven't necessarily disappeared. You know, I was talking about that Yoruba concept of having the doll there to represent them, you know, and all of these traditions have a space for ancestors, or egungun, as they say in Yoruba, where you're honoring these ancestors that are part of you, that their blood is running through your body, right? They're the reason you're here, and you're honoring with them. You're still in dialogue with them. So it's like they're gone, but they're not gone and disappeared, or they're not gone and in, you know, invisible, and that you're never going to be able to interact with them. There's also a concept which doesn't get talked about a lot, but there's a concept of a person being born with a twin soul, sort of. So when we reincarnate, one of them is said to stay up in the place of the afterlife, and the other one comes down to the earth, and they sort of rotate, right? Hmm. And they rotate into their own family line. So when we talk about reincarnation, it's usually you get reincarnated back into the same family bloodline. So we've got, I mentioned Baba Tunde Olatunde. Baba Tunde means father return. Baba Tunde.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So when we or Iyatunde, mother returns. Hmm. So we return where, and I think everybody's experienced this too. Oh, look, you know, my sister just had a baby. It looks like grandma, right? Like, or it loves this candy that grandma used to eat. So that's kind of like a re-welcoming of that spirit back into your life. It's not the same spirit as your grandmother. My daughter has red hair and my grandmother had red hair. So she's not this, they were both Virgos. It's not the same spirit, but it's very similar.
Yeah. I think that's super interesting. And I, you know, hearing you talk about that, I wonder if, you know, if you think that in a certain way, by severing our relationship with the ancestors, as we have done in the Western affluent white world, if that is part of what creates this fear of ghosts and the unseen world in this way, it's like become
definitely
uncanny, this thing that was once so familiar to us, right?
Yes, definitely. I think that, you know, and it's kind of, to me, disrespectful, right? Because we're not honoring them in the same way. We're not even honoring old people in the same way we did 100 years ago.
Isn't
so
that
just
the truth? Or the dying.
You know,
or the, yeah.
Yeah, or the dying. Yes, it's true. Not honoring that whole process. So
yeah,
I think that really creates an imbalance. And if you're walking around pretending you're not going to, we're all going to die, right? Like, you can't pretend it's not going to happen. You know, and maybe understanding what it was like when your grandmother went through it or your grandfather went through it will help you better understand when it's your time, or when you have to be around others and it's their time. So I think that, yeah, there is an imbalance. There is an imbalance. And it's also like that concept, right, of hungry ghosts, right? So this concept of they're not getting listened to, they're not getting fed, they're not getting honored, they're not getting remembered even in some cases.
Yes.
You know, and it makes me really sad.
Yes. And you know what that makes me think of as well is I spent some time in Korea and they did an exorcism there because there were some spirits that people had seen on the property, which was a battleground during the Korean War. And the way they did exorcisms, in contrast to the Roman Catholic tradition, was by feeding and offering alcoholic beverage and entertainment to the ghost. So it wasn't a punishment. It wasn't this
That's
idea
great.
Of get out. It was like, what might it need? What might it be asking for? How can we satisfy
it? I love that.
I loved it too. And it really just shows these different ways we can approach this idea of what we might experience as an unfriendly or unwanted intrusion from, you know, the other world, I guess you could say.
Yeah, definitely, right? Like, and I think that I've seen that too in possession situations where, in the African traditional religions, we don't banish the spirits when we're done with the ritual or we're done with the trance possession session. They leave when they want to leave, right? That's what it is. And we give them what they want, and hopefully they'll bless us and they'll, move along when they feel like it.
I would love for you to talk a little bit more about possession because I think that is something that, again, the Western affluent white world has a lot of fear around. And it is such a central part of African diasporic religions. And I would love to just hear you talk about what happens during possession, how you conceive of it, and what benefits it brings to the community.
Yeah, it's an intense thing, but not in an exorcist kind of way. Again, I think that's what people think is going to happen, right? Like, it really is allowing yourself to sort of be a vehicle for these divine beings or spirits that need a voice or need to be able to experience something in that moment. So it's a blessing for the individual. It's a blessing for the community. As you said, usually there's really important information for the community that they have. And a lot of times it's transformational. I remember once I was doing a ritual and somebody was in the back talking, and I'm such an Aries and a control freak. I'm like, you come here, right? Like, if you're going to be talking and interrupting, I'm going to give you a job. That's the spirit's way of telling me that, like, I've noticed you now. So now you're part of this whole thing that we're doing here. And I had given this man a machete, and he spent the whole night, it was an Ogun ceremony. He spent the whole night like leaping around, dancing with the machete, talking to all the people moving. And afterwards, he said, "Thank you. I don't know how I did that. I don't know how I was dancing and leaping around for hours. I just had surgery on my back. I haven't been able to move. I was only talking because I was worried that I wouldn't be able to last the evening. And I wanted to know if I should just leave now rather than walk out in the middle." So, like, there's so many of these things and that's just one story out of 100 that I have. But there's so many times where it sort of transcended the physical body that the person had, and they were able to move through the space with a sort of revitalized kind of energy and a renewal that I think is just beautiful, you know?
That is so interesting. And so, it goes back to this idea of transformation. And I think there has to be a death to experience a transformation. And I think many people are so afraid of giving over that control that is necessary for a real transformation to occur. And I hear that in what you're saying, and I think it's so beautiful. On that note, I'm wondering, if you could give our listeners out there any advice if they want to find a way to maintain or create a better relationship with their own ancestors, something simple they can
Oh, that's
introduce.
great. Well, the first thing I would suggest is gather as many names as you could, and if you're, I know some people out there are adopted or don't know the names. What I usually do is, even if you just have a clue, like, oh, okay, I know that my family was from this region. What are the common names in that region? And then get something simple like a pendulum or cards or some simple yes, no that you can do. My grandpa, two of my grandparents were named John and Mary. So if I was going to pick a list of common names, I probably would have put John and Mary on it. And look at that, they were John and Mary. So here we go. But just go through what names that you remember and try and make a list. If you have anything of theirs, I think that's also really helpful. I had a client and his baby was really sick. And I said, "Do you have anything of your grandfather's?" And he said, "I have my grandfather's spatula. I use this to make pancakes every Sunday morning." I said, "Okay, well, you can still use it to make pancakes on Sunday morning, but the rest of the week, take it, put a candle in front of it, write your grandfather's name, ask him for help. Ask him for help in this situation because, I mean, most of our grandparents and great grandparents understood sick baby. That's something that unfortunately we've understood for a really long time. So just that strength and wisdom that they have from going through it already can come and be a strength and wisdom for you in your time of need. So I think that's really helpful. So yeah, just find what you can, find what they, if you ask people what they liked, if anybody's old and still alive, right? Like, what did they drink? What was their favorite dessert? Those kinds of things. And in the process of creating that and leaving that in a sacred space for them, it doesn't have to be at the cemetery. If you can go to the cemetery, that's great. But if you just have a space in your house where you have pictures of your ancestors, you can leave it there with a white candle. You can leave it there with a glass of water. We say that those who offer water will have a time of rest. So I think that's really beautiful. Oh, okay. All I can afford today is water. So I'm going to rest and offer water.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the simplicity of it. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I want to come back as we're ending. Well, first of all, where can listeners find out more about you and your work?
Oh, okay. They can find more about me and my work on my website, lilithdorsey.com. My books are there. They can get a reading. I've got some really exciting public appearances coming up in Connecticut and New York over the next few months. So, yeah.
You also mentioned that you've done some films. Where can we see them, if at all?
I have a YouTube channel. Most of my films that are out for public consumption are on there, and you can see them there.
And what are you working on now? Are you working on anything you'd like to share with us?
I am working on a new book. We'll see what happens with that. I'm still doing a lot of live poetry readings and things of that nature. And like I said, I'm going to be in New York doing a big performance piece in the beginning of the fall.
And then I have three final questions that I ask all of our guests. How does the idea of death animate your life and work?
Oh, every day I feel my ancestors, and I lost a daughter, but she's still here with me every time I see a butterfly, you know. So for me, it just, again, just calls into my life humility, but also sublime regeneration, I think is the word I'm looking for, that these things still exist, the energy still exists, and it's here to help me move forward and help other people.
Yeah. Has your work changed what you believe does or does not happen after the death of the body?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I think the process is a lot longer than I thought it was. You know what I mean? Like just the process of getting used to being dead and being able to go and visit your loved ones and the things you have to do in the afterlife. Like that has really changed hugely for me, mainly because I had a lot of spiritual teachers that passed and it was kind of like Houdini where they were like, oh, okay, I'm going to come and tell you this thing after I'm dead. And it took them way longer to get the thing back to me than either of us thought it was going to take. So yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they did it, which is
yeah, they
amazing.
Did. Yeah. Sure. Of course.
And finally, if you could live forever, would you? Why or why not?
Only if I could be a hot vampire.
That is a very good answer.
Like, I don't want to keep getting older, bits are falling off me and stuff, right? No. I want to be like a young, hot vampire because they have all the money too, right? Like, so if I'm going to live forever, I want the money and the young, hot body. And then I'm in, sure.
Fair enough. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Lilith. And it's been a real pleasure.
You. It was a joy. Thank you.
All right. So, after each episode, my producer, Jess, and I like to sit down and have a chat about the recording while it's still fresh in our minds. And as always, I like to turn it over to Jess first because I tend to know more about the speaker and have less surprises than she does. So I'm going to turn it over to Jess. Jess, what are your thoughts on today's episode?
Well, I'll tell you what, everything was a surprise to me today because it was all completely new and fascinating. Lilith was so insightful about so many things, and I guess you know, growing up in the UK, this kind of work isn't something that we come across a great deal, so it's extra fascinating. So many things stood out to me. I loved the discussion about what we can do to ask for help from our ancestors, you know, something you and I were speaking about recently, and the way that Lilith was saying that the guy had his grandfather's spatula, that made sense, you know? Like if someone's made pancakes with those every Saturday, you know, and there's something in that, I think something really beautiful, you know, in those kind of small things. And leaving out the water as well, actually, is a lovely, really simple thing. And that actually made me think on my own like little altar space that I've got. I have a little empty cup that I saw the other day and it's really pretty. So I bought it and I put it there, but I didn't know what it was for. Now I know I need to put water in it.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And it's also interesting because although it's specifically, you know, she's talking about Afro diasporic religions here in Mexico. And I talked about this in my book, Memento Mori. I had an experience when I saw the home altar of a friend's mom. And she also had a white candle in front of a photo of her mother. And it was lit when I was there. And he explained, oh, that's because she's having problems with her daughter right now. So she's just been asking her mother for advice. There are a lot of overlaps between how it's practiced here and these African diasporic religions, which I think is really interesting.
That is really interesting. And then in terms of overlaps as well, when Lilith was talking about the concept of hungry ghosts and about leaving offerings or food, and that made me think about in China as well, the August, you have the hungry ghosts month where you leave out paper offerings and all different things, you know, to feed the ghosts because they're hungry, because they need that recognition. And if you don't, they are sort of stuck in this liminal space. And that seems to be a pattern in more and more cultures, like from the you know, as we're doing these episodes and I'm learning, you know?
Yeah, it's very common. And then you think, you know, listening to her talk, and I've heard shamans talk about this as well. If you think about it metaphorically, you know, what if there's some element of truth to this, whether it's a spiritual truth or not, we can never know. But think about all of the problems we're having in the world now and all of the hungry ghosts we've left, even if we're thinking symbolically, because we don't have these traditions anymore and we haven't been practicing them for the past 150 or so years, really, in the Western affluent white world, you know, which I think is just an interesting way of thinking about things. And this woman I know, Christina Pratt, who is a shaman, and she should be a future guest. She's fantastic. Mm. And she, when I interviewed her right in the wake of COVID, she talked about this. And from her perspective, this is a real problem. And also, if we tie that into the fact that we haven't had grieving traditions, so we also have the internal lack of closure or lack of a pain and a wound that doesn't get healed, I think. And if we think about these traditions having been lost that were millennia long, you know, only in the last 150 or so years, I think there's just something really interesting there.
Yeah, completely interesting and fascinating. I think you should do a whole episode about that.
Yeah, or maybe it's a series.
Yeah, I think that is a series, definitely. Yeah.
So, first of all, we want to thank you so much for being a part of Memento Morbid this season. This will be the final episode of this first season, but it is not the end of the story. Over these past 16 episodes, we have been joined by a rich assortment of guests, ranging from Academy Award-winning directors to practicing witches, religious studies professors to spiritualist mediums. We've met actors, former crematoria workers, death studies professors, scholars of Black Goth, and New York Times bestselling authors. And what I find when listening to all of these conversations together is certain unexpected themes, at least unexpected to me, begin to emerge. And one of the strongest and most profound of these, at least to me, is this relationship that I'm hearing between, on the one hand, thinking about death and mortality, and creativity or generativity. And I think we also begin to see how all of these individuals coalesce into a sort of constellation that is the Morbid Anatomy community. You can see how Morbid Anatomy itself is this community, and this community is the constellation that surrounds the Morbid Anatomy project. While we're working on our second season, we would still love to hear from you. So please keep sending any listener offerings that might come up for you. Maybe listening to a certain episode, something pops up for you, a reflection, a story, a question, an encounter with death that you had that resonates with one of these episodes or that doesn't. If something like that comes up for you, please leave us a voice note and perhaps you'll hear it on a future episode. The WhatsApp number is in the episode description and we'll keep listening throughout the break. And as you probably already know, this is an independently produced podcast. If you would like to support this podcast, if you'd like to hear more conversations like the ones that we are having here, if you think it's important or interesting, it enriches your life in some way, You can continue to visit the Morbid Anatomy online store, where you will find t-shirts, sweatshirts, mugs, stickers, and all sorts of other things with our logo designed by Death Doula and Morbid Anatomy community member Lawrence Seeley. You can find all of this at mementomorbidmerch.dashery.com. Every purchase you make goes directly into supporting this podcast, allowing us to build the future seasons and to bring in even more fascinating figures from the larger death community. To end, we all want to thank you, all of us here at Memento Morbid, myself, Jess, and the entire team. Thank you for being a part of this. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing it with others. Thank you for your comments that we've seen coming in. We're so gratified that this is interesting to people besides us. We love having these conversations and making them available, and we'd love to keep it going. If you want to find out more about Morbid Anatomy and what we're doing in the meantime, you can visit our website at morbidanatomy.org, and you can also check us out at Morbid Anatomy on all of the social medias, on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. You can also check out our Substack at mementomorbid.substack.com. where we try to not only provide notes on the episodes, but also many of the links to the sorts of things we've talked about and images, which are such an important part of what we're talking about here. Memento Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra. Studio engineer, Fernando Velasco. Additional production and sound design by Katie Hill. Executive producer, Stephen Rajam.